Hello and welcome to the Conscious Consulting Podcast, where we will introduce you to the Conscious Consulting philosophy. Together with our senior advisors from all around the world, we blend the deep knowing of wisdom traditions, technology, modern science, and business, and show you how to transform this wisdom into impact in your daily life as a consultant, leader, or entrepreneur. Welcome to the CCG community.
So, welcome to the Conscious Consulting Podcast. Our today's guest is Jean-Sébastien Simon, and he's a seasoned expert in leadership development and the founder of the Productive Behaviors Workshop, which has empowered thousands of business students with the essential soft skills to thrive in their careers. Over more than a decade, he has trained over 500 leaders in across sectors, from the military to private industry in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. But yet driven by a desire to explore deeper dimensions of life and leadership, Jean-Sébastien has embarked on a personal journey, studying philosophy, psychology, and spirituality. And that also took him to San Francisco, where he studied East-West psychology at the California Institute of Integral Studies, and also to India, where he practiced integral yoga at the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. Today, Jean-Sébastien bridges business and spirituality, coaching, consulting, and training visionary leaders with his conscious business approach and creating the first conscious business class at ESSEC Business School. And also, luckily, he is a cooperation partner of Conscious Consulting Group after meeting him last year at a conference and participating at the Conscious Consulting Masterclass. So welcome, Jean-Sébastien. I'm very, very happy that we meet here on the podcast.
Thank you very much, Julia. Thank you for having me.
So you are a leader in sustainability, training so many young people, which is extremely important, and working with leaders. And when I asked you what you would be most interested in talking about in that podcast, you said very clearly that you would like to talk about the intersection of psychology and our mindset with sustainability, and basically how we are limiting ourselves and preventing a more sustainable world with our own mindset. So let's just pick on that question. And before we go deeper in the question how we're limiting ourselves, I would be very interested in your take on sustainability and what a more sustainable world would even look like. So what is it that we are actually preventing ourselves from having?
Thank you, Julia. That's a great question and a challenging one. So I won't give an academic, definition of sustainability, but rather my personal opinion on the topic. I think a sustainable world can take different flavors according to who you ask. So, in the sustainability world, there's a lot of people who believe in what I call the frugality paradigm. So having less, producing less, consuming less. Some of them are part of more the degrowth movement and so on. So, it's more like, living with less and being more content, closer to the land, and reducing our desires and needs. And that's probably necessary, given the environmental crisis, the climate crisis that we face, and the huge consumption of resources that right now we're using as humanity. But for some other people, this vision is simply not possible, not realistic. The other day I was talking with a CEO of a top construction company in France, and he cannot even imagine degrowth. I mean, he just told me, he said, no, degrowth is not even possible. I don't think it's the solution. For me, the solution is to decouple growth from CO2 emissions and materials and energy consumption. So for some people, you're part of the largest emitters in the world in terms of CO2 and resource consumption. It's not going to go through degrowth. You won't see them tomorrow, living in huts and just eating vegetables from their garden. So for some people, it's going to be through finding more sustainable ways. And that's where the, business comes in. And I could elaborate further, but that would be a first, part of the answer.
Mm-hmm. So you now told me what some other people say. So what's your take? What do you think? Do you think that we need to find growth that's sustainable, or can we be only sustainable if we degrow?
We need to define degrowth. I'm very interested in the concept of degrowth because we need to define the terms. And so, usually, what people think when they think about degrowth is just slowing down the whole economy and stopping, basically stopping consumptions and reducing the size of our companies and so on, and each person, being deprived of needs and things like that. And that obviously is not a sexy scenario. But I like to look at degrowth from a different perspective. So there's a British so author, an economist, Kate Raworth, who wrote this book on donut economics. And donut economics is about how do we create an economy that prospers on the long term, that is both healthy for the planet, so it doesn't cross the planetary boundaries as defined by scientists from the Stockholm Resilience Center. So there's basically nine metrics that we can use to measure the vitality of our planet and if our planet is doing well. And if we violate these boundaries, it's going to be bad, for the climate, bad for biodiversity, and bad for us on the long term. And then that doesn't also violate the social aspects. So there's several social aspects such as education, gender equality, employment, etc. And so Kate Raworth, in her book called Donut Economics, explains that degrowth will actually be necessary. And she bases that on economic facts. For example, in the European Union, the OECD predictions for 2060 are that we'll have a growth between 0 and 1%, a GDP growth between 0 and 1%, including in countries such as Japan and so on. So economic predictions show that we won't have much growth and we might have recessions in countries that wouldn't be surprising in the next years in industrialized countries. Other countries, such as the BRICS, so India, Russia, China, and so on, will continue to have growth, but it's not going to be the case for all countries in the world. And so if we look at degrowth for countries like ours, like France, like Spain, and so on, Germany, Japan, some industries will continue to rise. So, we do need to produce more energy and things like that. But some industries might need to shrink if we want an economy that doesn't collapse our whole society. So some sectors such as landfills, some highly polluting sectors like oil and gas and so on will need to degrow. So degrowth will be growth of some sectors that are healthy for the economy, for the people, for the planet, and probably degrowth of some other sectors that are unhealthy. So looking at that, we can look at degrowth from a more nuanced perspective.
So maybe it would be way more healthy to look at very different ways than GDP growth and try to decouple from the financial system there.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a question around what metrics do we use that you raised that's really critical. And we talk about this in a class that we just launched at ESSEC Business School, where we talk about what indicators do we use. And instead of GDP, which was initially not used to measure the economy of a country, initially it was developed as a tool in the US by Simon Kuznets just to see what kind of monetary policy could be helpful for the US. And it got then used because it was a convenient tool, but then it got used and misused, I think, over the years. And then the question of, the country of Bhutan created this tool called Gross National Happiness Index, GNH, and it measures many other factors, including, how people spend their time, how much sleep they get, the impacts on nature, the impacts of culture, et cetera, and community vitality as well. When I take the metro in Paris and I see people, stuck on their phones or people having, sad faces or being, they look either apathic, if not depressed, if not sad, if very few people are smiley and happy, that's not a vital community, and that's the modern society that we live in many great cities. So that's a real question that you're raising.
What do you think would a world look like for us that's based on more sustainable ways of thinking and economy?
I have one example of a personal experience, and I'm not saying it should be like that in the whole world, but the experience I will give If the whole world worked like this, we would definitely work, live in a better world, that's for sure. But not everyone would be ready to make this leap. So 2023, I went to a community based in the southeast of India, and it's a nonprofit called Sadhana Forest. And what they do is that they have reforestation projects and afforestation projects in southeast India, in different other locations in India, in Haiti and in Kenya. They've been doing this for 20 years, where as a community, they go to a land that is severely eroded, so nothing can grow anymore. And they start basically a little community there, and they start planting trees. It's 100%, you know, it relies, you know, the majority of people are volunteers who go there to have this experience to just plant trees and live in a community. It's a wonderful community. It's 100% vegan. And when you're there, it's not just about planting trees. You have a real sense of community. You're with people who are open-hearted, open-minded. You feel like you're meeting your brothers and sisters. Everyone eats together. There's a cooking team, while another team will be planting trees. Some other people take care of, you know, the toilets, etc., etc. You work only half of the day, so only in the morning, and you have two a seva. So seva is a Sanskrit word for service. So you have two services. One, as soon as you wake up, you know, you get in a circle. You do a few warm-up exercises and so on. Then there's the first seva. So some people go in and prepare breakfast. Some others go tree planting. Some others do, you know, cleaning, etc., etc. Then we all have breakfast together. And then there's a second seva, and then there's lunch. And then people are free to do whatever they feel like in the afternoon. And these communities have been growing. There's many other, you know, tree planting communities in the world, but if human beings started, you know, regenerating nature, spending more time connecting with each other, it's a very low-tech community. The Wi-Fi is only available a couple hours per day. There's electricity, I think, only a couple hours, and then when you go back to your hut, you know, you use a lamp, and the toilets are 100% like compost and dry toilets. You use very little water per day. I think it's per person, it's maybe about 12 to 15 liters, whereas in Europe, you know, it's a shower is already 75 to 200 liters just for a shower, you know. So it's a very different lifestyle, and it's more fulfilling, to be honest. When I'm there, my levels of fulfillment and happiness are like a 9 out of 10. When I'm here in my daily life, between 7 and 8, 8.5 maximum, and it's not a constant flow. So we can decorrelate, you know, our fulfillment and experience as a human being from, you know, material life. That's for sure. That's one example. But there are also some high tech, you know, initiatives. So some companies which rely much more on tech, or organizations. There's a nonprofit called The Ocean Cleanup. They don't live in the forest. They don't live in huts. You know, they're based in the Netherlands. They have their headquarters in the Netherlands, but they have operations all over the world. And they use highly technological systems developed and co-developed by their founder, Boyan Slat, to filter out and to take plastic away from rivers and from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. And there's another company that's a non-profit, but there's a for-profit that does kind of the same, but using low tech. It's called 4Ocean. And what they do is that they pay fishermen in different places, I think in Thailand, Indonesia, and other places in the world, to pick up a plastic and trash from the sea. And they pay them by the kilogram of trash that they collect. And then the business model is that they sell bracelets made from little debris of plastic. The bracelets are made by the fishermen's wives, and they sell these, you know, bracelets. They're quite expensive, I think $25 or $50. So you're buying, you know, a $25 plastic bracelet, but that funds the operations basically. So people who wear these bracelets are highly environmentally sensitive. They're surfers and so on, and they're a highly profitable business, you know. So you can do business by regenerating and cleaning up. That's possible. I believe that we won't get out of our crisis only with sustainability. It's not by reducing by 10% or 20% or whatever that will go through. No, now we need to be really regenerative, and that's going to be necessary if we want to, because, you know, the human species does need regeneration, you know. That's a certainty I have. Sustainability is the minimum we can do. And at a larger scale, if we go through, some form of collapse or some form of, destruction of our, species, of our societies, economies, or whatever, as predicted by the Meadows report, for example, which they ran different simulations, and basically all the simulate d despite any measure that we could take, all the simulation show that it's likely that humanity will face some form of collapse before 2000, before the end of the century, before 2100. And collapse, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily a nuclear war, but it might be simply that we have to reinvent our economies, our ways of being. And we can see that COVID was a form of collapse in some ways. We've had to reinvent ourselves. So the question is, how will we reinvent ourselves as, as a species, as different societies, as human beings? And that's for sure. And we can see that at individual levels. I was reading the other day an article about an entrepreneur I really appreciated, Sam Ovens. He was the founding of consulting.com, hyper successful business online. He made millions. But after 10 years, I think he was burned out, or he, well, I don't know if he burned out, but he just felt that it was not, not fulfilling for him. So he had moved from New York City to the West Coast, to Los Angeles. And people who came to his masterclass were surprised to see him with long hair, with a t-shirt, whereas before he was wearing a suit all the time and having his hair super short cut and so on. And he founded a new community instead called school.com, SKOOL.com. And basically, what he was challenging people who were making also hundreds of thousands or millions, but didn't even know the purpose of why they were doing this, So he had this sort of probably identity crisis, or after being super successful, having this realization that that's not his words, but that's a thing that I remind my students is, you can try to win the rat race, but at the end, even if you win, you're still a rat, And that's a quote by Lily Tomkin. So it's the reminder of why do
I
we do
use
what
this
we
also
do?
in my book, this quote, because it's fantastic. Yeah, I love it too. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just them. I mean, I say that to remind myself as well, because working in a business school and coaching consulting can be easy to sometimes I'm in a rat race myself. Sometimes, I'm on the verge of burning out, or for me it's too much, or fortunately I have some support, but with coaches and so on and so forth. But just this reminder of when are we running after something that's not fulfilling us, or that's not gonna push us that far. So that's a reminder that we all need to keep in mind. I mean, yes, there are some very wealthy people who've got a lot of property, a lot of assets, but they are still, they are self-actualizing, or they're doing it from a place of service. So it really depends on the intention. Are you trying to nourish some ego? Are you trying to nourish some wounds? Because, it depends, people have different stories, different upbringing, different childhoods. Some people are doing it from a place of service, some people are doing it from a place of craving and need. And as you said, when you, it's like if you're eating food and you actually need to drink, or if you're drinking salty water, that's never going to quench your thirst, But I think about that because sometimes it happens to me after I go running or after I come back from sports. I try to hydrate as much as I can, but sometimes I notice myself eating a lot, and only afterwards do I think, oh, but actually I was thirsty and I didn't notice it because I was too,
Yeah.
pumped up by the exercise. So now I drink soup when I come back from
Yeah.
sports, in addition to food,
But in some sense, the question is, how can we be more healthy? How can we be more happy? How can we be more thriving as a society without it being at the cost of natural resources, including ourselves? Because we also natural resource, like human resources. I mean, that's incredible that we call ourselves human resources and not people, HR. So we consider ourselves as resources that are there to be mined and used and exploited for a different end. So anyway, it's not working right now. But why do we insist to continue exactly that?
the one word I would give is ignorance. And I include myself in there. It's our ignorance as humanity. That's one way of looking at it. I mean, I could do a multi-factor analysis and give you different, things, but if I crunched everything down to the bottom line, it's our own our own ignorance. And there's a quote by Gus Speth, who was a former administrator at the UN Development Program, he said, I used to think the top environmental problems were biodiversity loss, ecosystem collapse, and climate change. I thought that with 30 years of good science, we could address those problems, but I was wrong. The top environmental problems are selfishness, greed, and apathy. And to deal with those, we need a spiritual and cultural transformation.
Yeah, and that maybe brings us to the second part of the question is, what are the limiting factors? So why, if we all know that, and we even had the technology probably to change things and the information and everything's there, but what's preventing us to move on towards a more sustainable lifestyle? So what's the psychological, mental factors hindering us? I think we discussed already some of them.
So I would say yes, our state of consciousness is a big part of the problem. It's not the only one because obviously there's problems in policy, there's systemic issues, political issues, and so on. But I think we talk about these quite a lot, in the field of sustainability. And one problem that's kind of the elephant in the room that we don't talk about is the psychology and our evolution of consciousness as a species, as individuals, and as collectives. And so I can give you two examples, very concrete examples of how we're limiting ourselves. First, for example, a group of students that I was mentoring for a project on sustainability, students who specialize in sustainability, at ESSEC Business School, so it's the number one, number one master's in sustainability in France. It's been ranked number one, so they're you could assume they're good students, right? And yes, they are excellent students. Academically, they're great. But in this project, so students have to work by groups of four on the project to reduce the negative impacts, environmental impacts of the digital sector. Okay. And you had some groups who did really well, remarkably well, and they performed and they went to the finals and they finished number one in France. So they were really great. And some students who performed poorly. And I remember one group in particular who performed poorly despite their academic, excellence, because they had a conflict that they couldn't solve internally in the group. So students didn't get along for different reasons. And when I had a conversation with some of them, none of them was willing to take a step towards the other. None of them was willing to try a different perspective. Although I reminded them, hey, you had a negotiation and conflict resolution seminar by now, a 3-day seminar dedicated on these issues. By now you should be able to solve that. And I offered them suggestions. I asked them, if there was anything else I could do, and so on. And they didn't want to. And I could see that there were limitations from their own ego. They chose not to, although they probably were not conscious that they were choosing. Okay, that's one example. Another example on a project I worked on with other, people who were committed to sustainability. I don't doubt their intentions at all, but I could see a big difference in mindset between some people in the group who were very cooperative and some others who were putting a lot of bad will, despite being aligned and despite being experts in sustainability. It was a very different experience for me to lead a group like that of experts in sustainability, but some of them lacked some, I'd say, some human skills or cooperation skills. Whereas in some other project I worked on, people used to do like coaching and personal development and personal growth. Some of them might not know much about sustainability. Their carbon footprint might be very high, but in terms of working with them as human being, it's a joy. Like I would go to some of these meetings with a smile. I would come out with a smile. We'd have a blast. It was a good time. Whereas some of these other meeting with so-called sustainability experts sometimes could be really challenging, and I would come out drained of my energy. I would need to recharge and go in the forest and just forget about the project for a little bit. So, if we don't do the inner growth part, we're actually preventing everyone else from cooperating.
So the
Yes.
question is, how are we able to change the world if we're not even able to work together in a small group as students, where it's actually not even a very political environment?
Absolutely.
Did you use
There's one.
this
Yes, sir.
example to as a learning case in the group? So say, listen, this is what I observed. Are you reflecting that with your students?
Yeah, that's an example. With the students, a group of students I told you about, I reflected on what I noticed, and then I give them the choice because I can't make the decision for them. And basically they made the choice. I mean, different group members made the choice of just, no, it's not gonna work out. We're just gonna pass this class and do sort of the minimum that we need just in order not to fail the class. But you know, and they that was their choice. And I'm not saying it's a bad choice. What matters is that they made a choice consciously. But they consciously chose the stalemate and the to just maintain the dispute at a level that's acceptable or a not unresolved conflict for the rest of the semester. But there's yeah, as you mentioned, the IDGs, development goals that have been developed, to complement the sustainable development goals. So IDGs are internal and SDGs are external. Another coach, Andrew Moss, who works a lot with a framework called the Three Principles, said he would like to create a SDG called SDG Zero. And SDG Zero would be to do the inner work, of working on the mind and noticing ourselves in order to be able to face the SDGs better. But that's also because in the West, we need a lot to work with mind and with a framework. And when you work with people in the business world, people like frameworks or they need credibility and whatever. But I remember some of my experiences in India. A lot of people haven't haven't taught in or been with any students or in academic settings in India. But some of the people I work with or spend time with in India, you don't need to tell them about SDGs and whatever. And some of the children there, you explain to them how things work. That when you use such product and you dispose it then in nature, then it goes. They understand very easily. You don't need concepts, you don't need to talk about policy and so on. So we also need to understand who we're talking to, because for a lot of people in the world, it's not about making up new frameworks, reinventing the wheel. It's about coming back to basic understanding of things. And somehow, I believe in the West, sometimes we're too far up in our heads and we got maybe too sophisticated and we're too disconnected from, simplicity and what really matters,
That's one maybe of the key problems we're having, like this lack of simplicity and intuition and trusting ourselves and just understand that life is not so complicated.
Yes.
But we insist in making it complicated, but it's actually quite simple.
Yeah, we make it, and we can wake up from that. I remember when I came back from India, a person who was leading an NGO there asked me if I would give a talk to children for. So his NGO does work with children to help them with education and so on. So I accepted, and so I did an online talk. And I remember during the talk he. So I was giving him tips for like time management and how to study better and things like that. So basic things. And during the talk, he asked, the children, what are some of the important things in life, And some of the children started saying like, oh, sunshine and air and so on, some very basic things. And that reminded me, yes, I'm older with my like concepts of like time management and whatever, but there's even more basic things than that. And I know that now. I've put into the habit of like when I work in the morning, taking a break that's long enough so I can take a walk in the park, so I can breathe some fresh air, so I can move. When there's sunshine, appreciating the sunshine on my skin. And these are things that we can appreciate if we remember how important they are. And when I feel the sunshine, I'm like, yeah, remember that this is probably more important than whatever report you were doing before that or whatever. So remembering what are the essentials that we really need to leave. To live.
When I said the key takeaway from what's basically limiting us or keeping us from creating a more sustainable or maybe even simple but easier and also better life is our concept and our abstraction and our living in our heads.
I would say it's our level, our stage of development, our stage of psychological development as human beings. And so there's yeah, many philosophers, psychologists who've studied human development. Many of them, from Jean Piaget to Abraham Maslow, more recently Ken Wilber. I could give many names, and yeah, Robert Keegan from Harvard and so on. And basically, depending on where we are in terms of our maturity, we might or the more we evolve in life, the less we might limit ourselves. I mean, we create new limits for ourselves, but we sort of remove limitations that we had previously. So our task as human beings is to continue to grow and continue to evolve, so that we can each, actualize, we can all each mature psychologically, because, physically we mature until a certain age, early adulthood, but psychologically, some people reach their 60s and they still have the same, challenges that they have psychologically as in their, early 30s. So we can continue this work of, of developing so that we don't act as immature children in our 60s, and that we act more, wisely and remove some of these limitations that we had, because our limitations are in our perception of things. So,
So,
yeah.
does it mean that we as humanity are still very underdeveloped and still stuck in the materialistic needs mindset, like in the lowest one?
Well, I wouldn't say the lowest, but if you look at some of these studies on the evolution of humanity, humanity has reached, globally, a stage of development that is either in the, what they call more the sort of conformist or the modern, worldview. So the modern worldview being very rational, being focused on metrics and so on and so forth globally. A lot of it is still very, conventional. So looking at how to, how to fit in, how to fit in, family, how to fit in society, how to fit in, business or whatever. And we can move, forward and beyond that. And the following stage would be a stage of what's called a post-modernity. Some of the world is already there, but that's more the caring for the environment, caring for for each other, using a lot of, information systems and so on. And then beyond that, there's more, even more stages of development that allow for integration, for more actualization of one's potential, and so on and so forth. And so at each stage, you have new challenges that occur, but the previous challenges disappear, but you have more opportunities and more integration happening as well. And we're all moving in that direction of towards more wholeness, more fulfillment. Yeah, even though the road can be a rocky run, it doesn't mean it's so smooth, it's not a ride in the park. But yeah, it seems that we're moving in that direction.
Is it possible that this also works in cycles, that we maybe always have been in a human development as humanity at a stage where we actually were caring for each other and nature and living in cycles? Like we say, like a lot of the natural tribes that before Europeans arrived, I don't know, in South America, or the Aborigines, that they way more lived in harmony with the world, with nature, with the human nature, and with everyone. So that they were, in some sense, way more advanced than us, thinking we are so way more advanced in terms of technology and intellectual development. And suddenly, this is what we call the primitive cultures, not me, but in general, is actually way more advanced than we are psychologically, because they don't need so much. They're not so greedy. They don't need all these technologies that are very exploitative to enrich themselves in some sense, because they don't need all of that. It's just really confusing, because also this development is not a linear one, right? From coming from somewhere, going somewhere, but it's happening at the same time. And maybe in some sense we are more advanced technologically, but maybe not psychologically. Yeah, it is not easy. Where are we going?
Yeah. Where we're going, I
Don
can't tell
Sebastian,
you.
where tell us the way. What's
Let
now?
me tell you in 3 points where we're going.
What's most important now for all of us? What should we do?
Yeah, I'm certainly not qualified to answer this question, but
You're
one thing
Professor
is
Destek, you have.
but one thing is certain is we need, well, all these developmental models developed are based on the Western idea of progress.
Yeah.
The Western idea of progress as developed by, as expanded by Hegel and other philosophers, and we've built our Western mind on the idea of progress, that tomorrow is going to be better than yesterday. If you look at native cultures, first peoples all over the world, they don't have this notion of progress, because it seems that they live in symbiosis with with nature, with each other, and so on. So this model of development that I told about is rooted in the Western mindset, although it hasn't tried to integrate, perspective from other cultures. It's still based and rooted in progress. That's why I wrote an article that was published in the Council on Business and Society on the idea of progress itself, and distinguishing what you just said, distinguishing between material progress and psychological progress. And yes, as a Western civilization, I argue in this article that to some extent we have made some material progress. And in the article, I do also mention that we should stay humble about that progress because some, even materially, some. So there was a Russian scientist who called Kardashev, who came up with a scale to measure the material progress of a civilization. So it's called the Kardashev scale. And basically, he looked at different types of civilization based on how much energy they could harvest and harness in order to, expand. And he developed, I think, four scales, four levels. And then later scientists came up with a fifth and a sixth scale. And as humanity, we don't even score at the level one civilization. I think there was some research showing that we're at a 0.7, 0.7 type civilization. So, materially, we're still infants. And I would say it's a good thing. I argue it's a good thing because given the chaos we provoke on this earth, given the little material progress that we've done, it's a great thing that we haven't developed more when we look at the wars that are happening and so on. However, in terms of psychological development, we still have a lot to go. I do believe if we look at the Western world that we have made progress. I think that we live in a healthier and more mature society today than, let's say, if you think about the medieval epoch, I think it's better. If I look at France, the example of the country where I live, we're not hanging people anymore, but that was happening not that long ago. I think the last person was executed in France in the 70s, which is quite fairly recent. It's crazy for me to think. So I think we have made more progress in psychological progress, but there's still a lot, a lot to do. And I do see progress. Last year I was at a conference and there was a round table and there were two politicians at that conference. And to be honest, I don't hold politicians in very high, regard. I think a lot of them don't necessarily have some emotional maturity or lack some emotional maturity or wisdom. I'd love for us to have more political figures and business, business figures with more wisdom, not just intelligence or wits, but I'm talking about wisdom. And I remember one politician saying to another person after having had a discussion, "Oh, by the way, I would like to present my excuses because I think when I said that to you a bit earlier, I was lacking benevolence towards you." And I was shocked to hear this person say that publicly in front of, in front of other people on the stage. So it was a woman, but still. So
Yeah, that
yeah, I
explains a
think
little
there
bit.
is progress. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, what does progress even mean? I mean, that's again, it depends on where we come from. For some people, progress means more concreting of streets and more supermarkets and more shopping centers instead of a stupid forest. And for other people, it means
Yeah.
more progress is more forest instead of a regeneration of concrete
Yeah.
in turning
And that
to
depends on your level of
forest.
consciousness. Yeah.
And the question is also, what's the price we're paying for the progress we're making, and who is paying the price? So
Yes. Who's going to pay the bill? And that's a big concern. When I think about, people working in industry, because I like to make things concrete. I mean, I think, yeah, a lot of business leaders, they know what they're doing. They're not stupid. They're not crazy. They know some of the consequences, but just making it very concrete. Like, do you know that by adopting this policy for your company or by refusing to adopt this, the strategy for your company or to make it more sustainable or refusing to push a little bit more here, you're creating the conditions so that, yeah, maybe your children will go skiing, but your grandchildren will not be able to ski. Or for them, it's going to be a privilege, whereas two generations before, more people could go skiing. I mean, yeah, to be honest, personally, I don't mind if less cu human beings can go skiing, but I'm just trying to find what's the angle for the people to understand that their lifestyle will not be able to be, th they won't be able to pass their lifestyle necessarily through their children or grandchildren, or they will be because they are of the privileged class and the elite, and the elite will be able to, go on islands, move to another country. The elites won't be impacted the same way, but for most of a lot of human beings who don't have this, power status, this privilege, the resources, they'll be paying for the consequences. So few human beings, so a lot of human beings will be and are already paying the bill for very few human beings. It's like 1% of the wealthiest people on the planet emit as much CO2 as 50% of the poorest on this planet,
Yeah.
So yeah.
I'm so happy to see that shifting at the conscious education movement that's now going on. But it's slowly, slowly coming, right? It's getting some traction. How do you
It
see that?
is. And the good news is that students don't need to be convinced. At first, when I prepared some course material, I thought, okay, how to convince them of the so that. And actually, some of the feedback I got is that they know a lot of the facts already. They've been prepared already, including in high school in France. And they know a lot. They're convinced. I mean, we don't need to convince them, but they want to know the how. They want to know how do we make this happen. So that's an interesting thing. So for me, the question also around degrowth is also if it's not just about reducing our impact, how do we have conscious impact? Or we know it's going to have an impact. As human beings, we have an impact, in nature. Animals have an impact, they eat, ants feed off wood and they cut off wood and things like that. So they use, living is a destructive endeavor. We can't not be destructive. But as human beings, how can we be destructive in the most creative way? Or how can we do this as mindfully and consciously as possible? And so for me, there's a whole question around net impact. As an individual being, I might want to reduce my CO2 emissions. I've experimented, I haven't been on a plane for the last 18 months. It feels sobering. I could have never imagined I could have done that if you had asked me this, 5 years ago. But the question for me is, okay, if I hopped on a plane to go somewhere, what would make this worth it? If I was going to burn this fuel that took, millions of years to form and just a few minutes or hours to burn. And so, yes, it would need to be something that somebody else cannot do for me, that I cannot do online, and that's going to have a more positive impact by me being on that plane and in that other destination than just me staying at home or me doing a video conference. And so I think that's a question around that each of us can ask ourselves, what's my net positive impact? Even if you emit 10, 15, 100 tons of CO2 per year, what regenerative effects are you having? And how can you either absorb CO2 or help influence other people to reduce their emissions or help other people to become net positive, have regenerative aspects on biodiversity and so on? And so as human beings, we can reinvent ourselves as being a regenerative species, rather than a purely, destructive one. I think that's a question to look at that can give hope and that can remove some of the guilt of just, trying just to stay at home and not do anything.
Yeah, right. So it's about being net positive, and I think the same is true for businesses. It doesn't mean that you can't do anything, that you can't transform materials anymore into something. But this was the old Buddhist. Is it worth it? I mean, is what you create more valuable than what you destroy? And along the way, is it worth it? And for whom is it worth it? And who are you harming? But what I feel is it would be super important to start having those conversations with business leaders and with economists. At a certain scale, because this question is not even asked.
And that's the thing, when you help them, that's the thing about consciousness, because at success looks very different depending on your stage of consciousness or stage of development. And so in the modern worldview, success is just, making more, growing, and so on, more profitability. And then, when you move on, it's like, okay, we can have that, but that's a tool, that's a fuel for something else, something bigger. And that when it comes to the question of purpose, of positive impact, and so on. And so there are businesses, big businesses which have reinvented some of their business models. So, for example, Caterpillar started doing circular economy. So they used parts that were imperfect for manufacturing or unused parts or spare parts or things like that. And they, with the circular economy, they decreased, I think, by 90% their was it by 90%? I think their CO2 emissions and some of their waste, and they I think they increased by at least 50% their profitability on this line of products just by reusing spare parts that were not used or remodeling them and refurbishing them. So, big industries can reinvent and find, a lot of profitability in doing so. So it's also an economic, gain, but it goes beyond just the economy and beyond just increasing profitability.
Right. So the mindset change would be to also maybe decouple, or say, okay, we can have profit and a positive impact at the same time. I think
Yes.
why was you have to choose either or.
Yeah.
One is always at the cost of the other. And maybe we should think it on the contrary. Only if we have a positive impact, we can be profitable in future because, I don't know, talent, money, or clients will ask for exactly that. And only if we can prove or provide that, they will buy our stuff, work with us, and invest in us.
Absolutely. And that you talk about the mindset shift, that's a thing from degenerative to regenerative. And one of the questions a business leader can ask himself is, or themselves is, how can we give more for the same, cost? How can we give more? And giving more is to the client, to society, and to nature. So keeping our cost structure the same, how can we offer more? How can we build more, build in more sort of service? Positive value regeneration, including for biodiversity, for the same, for the same cost. And by doing that, that creates a prosperous mindset and it creates more value. And over time, it builds innovation, it builds social capital, it builds healthy relationships with the society, and it builds, sustainability within the environment. And it creates great brands. If you look at Patagonia, brands who really think in terms of how can they offer more. They have tremendous brands. Or Interface, the carpet manufacturer, which created carpet tiles which are which are CO2 negative, so they absorb more CO2 than they emit. That's a huge innovation, and they have this kind of mindset to develop these products, and they're a leader on their market.
Also financially sustainable at the same time, not in spite of it, but because of it. May we close with this beautiful vision of how reimagining how a different world of business could look like? I think we have to make it possible in our minds and hearts that this is a way. Yeah, so thank you very
Yeah,
much
absolutely.
for that fun discussion and interesting inputs and very thoughtful ideas of yours. And see you soon.
Thank you very much, Julia. Thank you for this wonderful conversation.